This is Maritime Accident Casebook with Bob Cooty.
Three men lay dead in the anchor locker, killed by an assassin that was all around them. What they needed to live was everywhere, except in one place, the air they breathed. The Case of the Rusty Assassin. Their names were Robert Ebertovsky, Bob O'Brien, and Finley McFadgen. Real names, real people. People like you. Their ship was the Emergency Response and Rescue Vessel, ERRV, Viking Aile, which serviced the Ensco 92 jack-up drilling rig in the Amethyst gas field about 25 miles off the East Yorkshire coast. She was classed with Lloyd's Register and managed by Vroon Offshore Services in Aberdeen. Robert Ebertovsky was a 40-year-old Polish AB. He'd worked on LPG carriers as an engineer and had worked for Vroon since 2005. He was a day work seaman. He didn't take a watch, but carried out routine duties during the day. Bob O'Brien was British. Like Robert Ebertovsky, he was a day work seaman. He was 59, had worked for Vroon for 7 years, and was the ship's advanced medical responder. It was a task he was well qualified for. Previously, he'd been a medic with the British Army. On the day of the incident, Bob O'Brien was the leading hand, the seaman designated by the ship's master to be in charge of Robert Ebertovsky. Finley McFadgen was a big man. He'd been a motorman oiler in the British Merchant Navy for several years. He worked in the ERV industry for 7 years and for Vroon for nearly 2 years. Now he was the 8-12 seaman who took the 8-12 watch in the morning and evening. These were experienced, qualified seafarers, used to the ship and their jobs. On Friday 21st September, Viking Aile docked at Immingham after 28 days on station for a crew change. On her way into Immingham, her starboard anchor had been walked out a short distance to make sure that it was clear to run out in case of emergency. Her anchors weren't much used. It was forbidden to anchor near the Ensco 92 rig, and she was tied up in port at Immingham. There wasn't much reason to go into the anchor chain locker, except once in a while to secure the anchor chain where it entered the spurling pipe that led to the windlass to stop it making a noise. Most of the time, the anchors are in the hawse pipes and the spurling pipes sealed with expanding foam to prevent seawater getting in. The next day at 11:50, Viking Aile set sail for Ensco 92. The starboard spurling pipe was resealed with foam, and at 16:25, she took up her station to start her 28-day standby. We can't know the fine details of everything that had happened over the next 24 hours. Those who can tell us are no longer alive, but it must have gone something like this. The weather was fairly benign, with half-metre seas and 1.5-metre swells. Not uncomfortable, but enough to rattle the anchor chain in the spurling pipes. Finley McFadgen's cabin shared a bulkhead with the anchor chain locker, and he heard the clank, clank, clank of the chain clearly, especially when trying to sleep. McFadgen, Ebertovsky and O'Brien had breakfast together the next morning and talk about the noise of the anchor chain. Work starts at 8 a.m. and McFadgen takes the watch. He tells the master that Ebertovsky and O'Brien want to go into the anchor chain locker to secure the chain and stop it banging. The master agrees but says that work can be done after a helicopter movement to the rig. It's Viking Aile's job to be on standby in case of an emergency. After the helicopter has left the rig, the master goes to his cabin to use the lavatory. McFadgen is alone. At 10:55, Ebertovsky and O'Brien take a handheld VHF radio to maintain contact with McFadgen on the bridge and go to the foredeck. They open the hatch to the forecastle store, go through the collection of ropes and deck gear to the aft part of the store. There they lift up the loose duckboards to reveal three bolted manholes, one leading to the four-peak water ballast tank and two smaller ones to the anchor chain locker. There they undo the 18 bolts securing the manhole cover to the starboard side of the anchor chain locker and remove it. Ebertovsky climbs through the tiny accessway into the unlit, unventilated space below with a piece of light rope to secure the anchor chain. He doesn't make it. He falls, unconscious, at the bottom of the ladder. O'Brien radios McFadgen. Ebertovsky is in trouble. McFadgen runs from the wheelhouse through the accommodation, calling for help. He's joined by the chief and second mate. Meanwhile, Bob O'Brien goes down into the anchor locker. He collapses, unconscious, on top of Ebertovsky. McFadgen and the two mates reach the forecastle store and look down into the locker. In the darkness below, they can see the bodies of Ebertovsky and O'Brien. McFadgen and the two others go back to the accommodation to get rescue equipment, including a self-contained breathing apparatus for the rescuers and an emergency escape breathing device for the victims. By now, the master is back at the wheelhouse and sounds the general alarm, rousing the rest of the crew. The crew meet at the muster station after the accommodation, then make their way to the foredeck as the master radios ENSCO 92, which prepares to assist. McFadgen enters the forecastle store wearing the breathing apparatus. With him is the ship's cook, carrying the emergency escape breathing device. Another seafarer dons the ship's second BA set and positions himself beside the forecastle hatch with the chief mate. Inside the forecastle store, McFadgen tries to enter the anchor locker, but he's too big to get through wearing breathing gear. He takes off the gear, grabs the emergency escape breathing device from the cook, puts its hood over his head, and climbs into the anchor locker. The cook goes to the other side of the forecastle store to get torches. Meanwhile, the chief mate tells another seafarer to put on the discarded BA set and stand by. When the cook returns to the access way, he can see that McFadgen is in trouble, the emergency escape hood pushed high on his forehead, air still escaping from it. The air bottle lays on the other side of the locker, the hose stretched tight. McFadgen collapses as the cook looks on, helpless. One of the seafarers with a slender build gets through the access way wearing breathing gear. First, he checks McFadgen. The emergency escape breathing device has already run out of air. There's no sign of breathing or pulse. He ties a line around McFadgen, climbs out the anchor chain locker, and with another seafarer, hauls McFadgen into the forecastle store. There's still no sign of life. Then the low air alarm sounds on the first seafarer's breathing apparatus, and both of them go up on deck to replace air cylinders. The first seafarer is too exhausted to continue, so the third engineer takes over and dons the breathing gear. The master now calls the Coast Guard for help and more supplies of air. Several nearby ships hear the call and offer help. Meanwhile, a specialist-trained four-man extraction team with a medic is ready on ENSCO 92, awaiting transfer to Viking Islay. It's now 11:25, around half an hour since the collapse of Ebertovsky and O'Brien. The two seafarers wearing breathing gear pull McFadgen out of the forecastle store to the deck, where CPR is tried unsuccessfully. At 11:40, the Viking Islay master finally manoeuvres his vessel close enough to ENSCO 92 for the rig rescue team to transfer by personnel basket, and by 11:51 they're aboard and take over rescue efforts. It takes another 40 minutes for both crews working together to get Ebertovsky and O'Brien out of the anchor chain locker. More than one of the seafarers aboard Viking Islay was astonished that three men, their workmates, could simply collapse and die in an anchor chain locker. Many of the seafarers on the ship, including the master, didn't think of an anchor chain locker as a dangerous place, even though they had long seafaring experience. And that almost certainly included Robert Levitovsky, Bob O'Brien, and Finley McFadgen. Some of the 12 seafarers on Viking Islay certainly were aware of the dangers of anchor chain lockers, but not all. Whatever orientation, training, and education they'd had wasn't adequate. It might have helped if Viking Islay had a list of dangerous enclosed or confined spaces that the crew to refer to, but they didn't. It wasn't what was in the anchor chain locker that killed the three men, but what wasn't? Oxygen. Yet it was all around them, in the rust on the anchor chain and on the bulkheads. Viking Islay's anchor locker was almost airtight. Its two small manholes were each bolted down with 18 nuts, with a rubber gasket around the holes to make them water and airtight. The spurling pipes were sealed with expanding foam. Air couldn't get in or out. It hadn't been fully ventilated for at least 15 months. True, a small amount of air might have got in through the spurling pipes when the anchor chain was broken free of the expanded foam when entering and leaving Immingham, and when the crew members entered to secure the anchor chain. But it was too little to have much effect on the makeup of the air in the locker. We're all familiar with rust. Seafarers spend a lot of time grinding it away, cleaning it off with wire woolen brushes, and attacking it with chipping hammers. It's a ship's enemy in more ways than one. The atmosphere inside the locker was damp and salty with seawater, ideal for iron to react with oxygen and produce rust. The iron sucks oxygen out of the air and basically locks it up. Over weeks and months, the anchor chain and bulkheads of the Viking Islay's anchor chain locker sucked oxygen out of the air until it might have been as low as 4% in places, about a fifth of what you need to live. On Viking Islay and other ships in the Vroon fleet, men have been into the anchor chain locker to secure noisy anchor chains. Why didn't anything happen to them? In fact, it probably did. They just didn't notice. When securing the anchor chain, they didn't need to go very far into the locker, so they were working the freshest part of the atmosphere, while the air below them, where they didn't go, became increasingly short of oxygen. But the air they worked in could have had as little as 11% oxygen, and they wouldn't have noticed that their physical and mental performance was being affected. Possibly, Robert Ebertowski initially fell because he was confused due to the lack of oxygen. Also, it's likely that no one had been into the anchor chain locker since before the summer, so it had remained closed for a long period, with the rust sucking more and more oxygen from the air. By the time Robert Ebertowski entered the locker on 23rd September, the level of oxygen could have been low enough to cause almost immediate unconsciousness. Below 6% oxygen, fainting is almost immediate, and even if you're rescued, there's a good chance of permanent brain damage. Why didn't they test the air before going in? They couldn't. Vroon Offshore's policy was that no one should enter an enclosed space unless the ship is in port and with specialist personnel present. It must have seemed like a good idea to the management officer, sure, but it's simply not realistic under normal operating conditions at sea. It hadn't been thought through. It didn't provide guidance on what should be considered a dangerous space and under what conditions. When companies make impractical rules, those rules soon get ignored or reinterpreted. On the Viking Islay and other ships in the fleet, seafarers were regularly going into the anchor chain locker to tie off anchor chains. It wasn't a matter of urgency, yet it put them at risk. They didn't take much notice of the sign attached to the aft bulkhead of the forecastle store, just above the access hatches to the anchor chain locker, that said, in big readable letters, "Enclosed space, no access, do not enter," because they didn't know the risk. Because of that no-go policy, Viking Islay was not provided with the appropriate atmosphere testing equipment. The men couldn't have tested the atmosphere even if they wanted to. There had once been a personal oxygen alarm unit on board, a CROCOM Icon. It couldn't be used for testing oxygen levels in an enclosed space. By the time of the incident, it had been replaced with a disposable personal hydrogen sulfide gas monitor. Not quite the right tool for the job. In fact, there weren't any portable fans or lights aboard Viking Islay either. Nobody was supposed to go into spaces that required extra lighting or ventilation. The Vroom policy was, to say the least, short-sighted. Vroom did, of course, have a safety management system. It was followed in June 2006 when contractors carried out work in that same anchor chain locker while in port, but it was not followed when men went into the anchor chain locker to secure the chains. Men on Viking Islay did undergo drills for rescuing people from confined spaces using the ship's laundry, but they hadn't done drills to practice getting through the sort of small access hatches that led to the anchor chain locker. If they'd done so, they'd have foreseen the problem of getting a big man like Finlay McFadyen through such a small hatch with BA gear on his back. If they'd have known that, then maybe a smaller man might have been chosen, or they'd have used the same techniques as the Enscon 92 extraction team. Put the air tank through first, while keeping the mask in place. With that knowledge, Finlay McFadyen wouldn't have had to resort to the emergency escape breathing device. EBDs are one-way tickets. You don't use them for going into a situation, you only use them for getting out of one. Under the best conditions possible, he had 10 to 15 minutes of air, but these weren't the best of conditions. Unlike self-contained breathing apparatus, EBDs deliver air at a fixed flow. The chances are that McFadyen was trying to breathe more air than the unit could supply. The hood closed over his face and he felt as if he was suffocating. That's when he pushed up the hood, tried to breathe the oxygen-deficient air, and collapsed. McFadyen hadn't been exposed to realistic training in the use of EBDs under stress. Had he been, his decisions might have been quite different. He might still be alive. Vroom's SMS system required several steps before entry into an enclosed space. A risk assessment, the preparation of a toolbox talk risk identification card, and the issue of a permit to work. At the time, Vroom's SMS didn't clarify its no-go policy, and individual ships were authorized to make their own risk assessments. In fact, there were several errors on Viking Islay's risk assessment, including a disparity between the risk assessment and what was available on board. TRIC, or Toolbox Talk Risk Identification Cards, is a safety system used in the offshore industry. Any non-routine task requires a TRIC, which identifies hazards not covered in the risk assessment and the control measures needed, and records them on the card, which is signed by the master before work begins. On Viking Islay, it was common for TRICs to be signed after the job was done, which rather made them a pointless exercise. The master didn't think of the anchor chain locker as a dangerous space, which may be why he approved the job without talking to the mate who normally supervised deck operations. All the same, going into the chain locker wasn't a normal part of the seafarer's day, so he should have had the seafarers follow the TRIC procedures at the very least before starting work. Another part of the safety system is the permit to work, or PTW, to be completed and issued before work begins. That wasn't done either. These paper systems, like the enclosed space entry permit used on other ships, make sure that you know what the risks are, that you have what you need to stay out of trouble, and what's needed to get you out of trouble if something goes wrong. There is one rule that would have kept O'Brien and McFadgen alive. Don't attempt to rescue someone from a confined space without backup and the right equipment and training. It's instinctive to go straight in after a shipmate in trouble or who's unconscious, without thinking of your own safety, and when you don't actually know what's causing the problem. One of the reasons why enclosed space or confined space casualties are so high is that too often would-be rescuers die too. Like a supermarket two-for-one offer, death gets a discount. It takes discipline not to go after a shipmate in trouble until you've ensured that your own life isn't at risk. If you don't have that discipline, you reduce the chances of saving a friend, you increase the dangers to yourself, and you put the lives of your other shipmates on the line. As a seafarer, you have a right to work in conditions that are as safe as they reasonably can be. But you also have a responsibility to yourself and your shipmates to work as safely as you can, to keep your wits about you and an eye out for dangerous situations. So how do you avoid being a victim of the rusty assassin? First, think about whether you really have to go into the space at all. Is the job that urgent, or is there another way to solve the problem? If there's rust in the space, and it could be an anchor chain locker or a ballast tank or even a cargo hold, assume that it's dangerous even if it's not mentioned in the SMS or on a list of dangerous spaces. Your brain is there to be used, use it or lose it. Test and ventilate the space until the oxygen is around 25%. If you can't test or ventilate, and the men on the Viking Islay couldn't, then don't go in until or unless it can be tested and ventilated. Keep a safety watch. Always have rescue equipment immediately available beside the point of access. Don't just plonk it there. Think about how you're going to use it. Can you get through the access way wearing breathing apparatus? Are you sure? And if you're the one going into the space, make sure the person on safety watch knows how to use the equipment. Don't be tempted to use an EBD for rescue. It's for escape only. It's a one-way ticket. Follow the safety procedures in the SMS. Make sure all the necessary documents are completed and signed before you enter the space. They're as important as the brakes on your car. Every job aboard ship should have a job safety analysis, JSA, which identifies safety issues in carrying out the job. There wasn't one for securing the anchor chain on the Viking Islay, probably because it wasn't a formal job. If there isn't a job safety analysis for the task you're carrying out, you'd better find out why. Before carrying out the job, a toolbox talk should identify who does what, the tools needed, the risks involved, and what to do if something goes wrong. It's a good way of reminding yourself and others of safety issues and precautions. There wasn't a toolbox talk on the Viking Islay, and the results speak for themselves. It doesn't matter how often you've done that job, have that toolbox talk. The more often you do a job, the more familiar you get with it, the more likely you'll forget safety precautions. Even if others on your ship, including officers, have a casual attitude towards safety, remember,